This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The pastor of one of Bloomington Normal's largest congregations ignited controversy in 2017 with a sermon that criticized non-traditional families and suggested homosexuality as a choice.
Saying that I was born this way is actually, not biblically founded. Now, it's not scientifically founded either. It's not been proven in a scientific lab that people have a genetic for sexuality.
The pushback to Pastor Mike Baker of Eastview Christian Church was one of the top stories listened to on GLT this year. Others include the investigative series Landlord v. Tenant, the struggle to improve police and resident relations with a citizen review board, criminal charges against former Bloomington Coliseum managers, and more. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Eastview Christian Church is one of the area's largest congregations, with more than 5,000 members. In August, Eastview's Pastor Mike Baker talked about sex. Baker touched on a variety of topics, but his remarks on homosexuality and non-traditional families in particular ignited criticism from some members of the community who say the sermon disrespected the LGBTQ community and families that don't fit the traditional mold. Here's the story from August by GLT's Judy Valente.
Pastor Mike Baker stands on the large stage at Eastview Christian Church that serves as a pulpit. He's dressed casually in a summer suit, open-collar shirt, and loafers with no socks. Behind him, lit up in stage lights, are the letters S-E-X.
We are not a bunch of people who are against stuff. Okay, we are for things, and the thing that we're mostly for is Jesus Christ. And so today, I'm going to present for you the plan for sex that God has for you. I just want you to understand this. No matter who you are, what you think about the church and sexuality, God wants you to have sex. God made you as sexual beings. Sex is cool with Jesus.
Baker says at the outset he does not intend for his remarks to be disrespectful.
The reality is, we're not haters. There's no hate in here. Hating rhymes with Satan, all right? And so we don't hate here.
And he says he's not suggesting that sex is evil, but is merely trying to clarify biblical teaching. He cites the second chapter of the book of Genesis, adding his own take on why he believes sexual relations are only proper between a man and a woman.
God made man's penis to fit perfectly into a woman's vagina. Actually, they become one flesh. The physical side of this is fascinating in God's creation.
As Baker spoke, about 25 protesters from a group calling itself Humans for the Advancement of Religious Equality gathered outside the church. They held signs they said reflected their interpretation of Christian scripture. Messages such as, God doesn't make mistakes, and you are beautifully and wonderfully made. Baker's sermon has provoked a public airing of the kinds of internecine disputes that exist between Christian churches over sexual matters. The sermon touched on a variety of subjects, including pornography, masturbation, and sex outside of marriage. Baker asserted homosexuality is a choice that can be overridden by will, and his remarks about non-traditional families sparked the biggest outcry, not only from LGBT activists, but a local feminist group, a Bloomington City Council member, and members of other Christian denominations. Jackie Gunderson, a member of Hope Methodist Church, organized the protest.
I am actually the leader of a small group of Christians. Some of us are LGBTQ Christians and some of us are allies, and we've all experienced or witnessed the hurt that Christians and churches have caused.
Gunderson cites Eastview's prominence as one of the largest churches in the county, with more than 5,000 members, about a third of them under the age of 29. Eastview even rented a billboard along Veterans Parkway to announce Baker's sermon on sex.
We are not arguing with Mike Baker's interpretation. That is his interpretation. What we were there for is to show love to those who left confused or hurt or unsure of what they just heard. because we have all felt that.
Baker's remarks on sexuality reflect the teachings of most evangelical Christian churches, as well as some mainline churches and the Catholic Church. The swift negative response to the sermon underscores a growing issue for churches like Eastview that make extensive use of video, web posts, Twitter, and other social media. Those media venues leave the comments of pastors open to far greater public scrutiny than ever before.
Eastview is a very big church. They use the billboard and the Facebook posts and spreading that message on Twitter to attract more people there. We were really hoping that as they attracted more people, on top of the thousands that they connect with every Sunday, that they might use that platform to be inclusive and loving rather than excluding and gaslighting an individual or a group of individuals.
GLT News asked Baker to comment on his sermon. He replied through a church official that he was leaving on a retreat to write a book and would not be available. However, Gunderson said Baker contacted her by email earlier this week, seeking a future dialogue with her religious equality group.
I fully support freedom of religion, and people can have whatever beliefs that they have. But I believe it's my duty as an elected official to stand up for those who are in the minority.
Bloomington City Council member Scott Black listened to the sermon on YouTube. At a council meeting last Monday, he said he felt compelled to respond.
I was really disappointed to hear in that piece a lot of hate towards the LGBT community, and it really bugged me.
In his sermon, Baker argued homosexuality is an identity people choose and not one they are born with.
Saying that I was born this way is actually, not biblically founded. Now, actually, here's what's interesting about this. It's not scientifically founded either. This is what's really interesting. In a study by Dr. Sari Van Anders, she's the University of Michigan professor of psychology. She says the science of whether sexual orientation is biological is pretty sparse and full of disparate and mixed and unreplicated findings. In other words, it's not been proven in a scientific lab that people have a genetic for sexuality.
The sermon included an interview with author Eric Elder, a member of Eastview, who said he entered into homosexual relationships as a 19-year-old young man, but later in life married a woman and fathered 6 children.
Deep down, I knew that what I wanted was a wife and kids and a family.
Elder's book, Loving God and Loving Gays, What's a Christian to Do, is recommended on Eastview's website. He told the congregation, with Jesus' help, anyone can overcome homosexuality.
2 blind men came to Matthew, and they said, have mercy on us. And Jesus said, do you believe that I'm able to do this? And I felt like Jesus was asking me the same question. You want to be changed. Do you believe I could do this? And I thought about everything I knew about Jesus and what I'd learned in church. He healed the sick. He walked on water. He raised the dead. I said, if anybody could do this, you could. Mm-hmm. And I was holding my Bible, walking along the road, and I put my hand up, and I said, yes, Lord, I believe. Mm-hmm. And Jesus said, according to your faith, it will be done to you.
Amen.
Gunderson of the Religious Equality Group said she was particularly concerned about the message Baker and Elder were sending to young gays who might still be coming to terms with their sexual identity.
Suicide attempts are 4 times higher for LGBT youth. 40% of transgender adults reported suicide attempts before the age of 25. And this is why I stood outside ECU on Sunday. LGBT youth from rejecting homes are 8.4 times more likely to commit suicide when they come from rejecting homes.
Baker spent a portion of his sermon advocating for the traditional family.
The very best place for us to have children is in a loving, tight-knit, nurturing community called mom and dad. And in the midst of that, you raise children, because that's the best place for them. They need dad, they need mom.
One of the most stinging criticisms came from a women's rights group called FIST, Feminists Instigating Social Transformation. A lengthy essay on FIST's Facebook page says, quote, FIST refuses to sit quietly by while members of our community are having people in fancy suits with multi-million dollar pulpits preaching intolerance, hatred, and bigotry with a smile. Mel Haney, a single parent, co-authored the essay with her sister.
Specifically pointing out that, you know, families need a mother and a father because, you know, women are kind and soft and men are, you know, strong and the disciplinarians. I think it just perpetuates, one, single parent families feel like they're not enough or they have a lot of guilt about not being able to provide the other parent. And then also that also targets the LGBTQ family community, so they feel like they're doing something wrong with how they're raising their children.
The comments on family also provoked Bloomington Councilmember Black, who says he comes from a family of divorce.
My mother did a great job raising me. My dad was involved in my life, too. I'm very fortunate for that. And to suggest that people who come from homes is described as broken without a father and a mother figure together is really offensive and deeply troubling, because I think it's never a good thing to tell kids they can't do something because of their circumstances. I think it's important that we lift people up.
Haney of the FIST Women's Group says she has since heard from people who attend Eastview who say they don't ascribe to the church's teaching on sexuality. She says there are gay members of the church who are afraid to speak up.
It's a very us versus them mentality that I wish didn't exist.
Bob Ryder is co-pastor of New Covenant Community Church in Normal, which describes itself as inclusive. Ryder says many church leaders in Bloomington Normal would agree with Baker, but that is beginning to change.
Human sexuality is a lot more complex and nuanced than we've ever known up until, you know, the last number of years or decade or two. And the more we find out about sexuality, the more we hopefully will come to realize that there are many valid and beautiful and legitimate expressions of sexuality. I think more and more Christians and more people of all religious faiths are starting to understand that from a more informed, scientific, biological point of view than a strictly 2,000-year-old perspective in which the Bible was written.
Baker of Eastview ends his sermon by asking his congregation members not to engage in debates, especially on social media, with others who might not ascribe to Eastview's teaching on sexuality. But he advises,
ask them to tell you their story. Ask them to share with you what they think about sexuality. Get into their life. And then, hopefully, there will be a reason or an opportunity that you can do this final one. Always point to Jesus.
Baker also acknowledges that Jesus never speaks directly about homosexuality in the New Testament.
People say Jesus never spoke about it. And technically, in terms of the scriptures, it's more proper to say that we don't have recorded words of Jesus talking about it.
But Gunderson of the Religious Equity Group says the New Testament message of Jesus is clear.
Show love to others because that's what Jesus commanded. You are a Christian. Your job is to love others.
Haney of the FIST Women's Group says what's also clear is that people who are divorced, gay, transgender, and once felt marginalized by churches are now less likely to simply stay away.
I would love to see people be able to be themselves and be able to follow, you know, whatever faith they choose, you know, whether it's Christianity or, you know, Buddhism or Judaism. I would love for people to stay and to fight and to make sure that people see them not as, you know, flawed human beings, but actual human beings that are worthy of respect and worthy of human rights and dignity.
But Haney warns, that day is not here yet. I'm Judy Valente.
Mike Baker joined Eastview Church's staff in 1995 as a youth minister. He's been senior pastor since 2007. He's the author of several books on faith, including How Teens Do Church.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Social media has changed so much for local businesses, how they find new customers, how they shape their brand, even how they promote upcoming sales. But what happens when it turns on them, when Facebook becomes a threat to their very survival? In September, GLT's Ryan Denham looked into one recent example here in Bloomington Normal, when a Facebook post was the spark that sent a young mother to jail.
No, you can't get arrested for lying about other people on Facebook. If that were the case, we'd need a lot more jails. But if you lie about something really serious, like child abuse, and then lie about it again to police and Child Protective Services, then you've got a problem. That's allegedly what happened last week when 31-year-old Trisha Donius was arrested. She's charged with filing a false report with the Department of Children and Family Services and obstruction of justice. Here's Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner on how it all began one Sunday in late August when Donius allegedly posted on Facebook a photo of a child who she said was abused by staff at the Shining Star Learning Center, a daycare in Normal.
We became aware of a social media post. It was reported to us. So once we were made aware of that, our detectives looked at that social media post and realized that that was something that certainly needed to be reported. It would be a mandatory reporter situation if it was a caregiver. So they then reached out to the individual that made the post. And so then started the investigation based on those statements.
Police say Donius stuck by her story that someone at Shining Star abused the child. Police say that's false and that she knew it. Jill Waller is executive director at Shining Star Daycare. She says the past 2 weeks have been traumatic and very frustrating. She appreciates Normal Police for exonerating her business so publicly after the arrest was made, but it was hard for Waller and her staff to keep quiet for more than a week before Donius was arrested. She says they knew the alleged abuse didn't happen at their daycare, but they couldn't say so publicly.
From an outside perspective looking in, it probably looked like we just weren't stating what was going on, but yet we felt we needed to be cooperative with authorities who were completing the investigation. And then once a formal arrest was made, then we were able to say our side of what was happening.
Then last Wednesday, more than a week after the original Facebook post, Donius was arrested. Here's Jill Waller.
It was a huge relief. From the day after the post was made, we had five staff who were under close monitoring supervision from DCFS. And even though we knew they were innocent, we still had to follow procedures from DCFS. And so it was a very much a relief to all of us to know that that was the end of that part. You know, the end is not over because there are complications now because of the post that had been out there about our business. But we will get through that, and we can move on from there.
So what was put on Facebook exactly, and when?
I believe the date was August 27th. It was a Sunday evening. A former mother from our daycare put a post including pictures of physical abuse that had taken place with two of her children, and she was accusing the staff at the daycare for the abuse. And it just went crazy. Then on Monday, the 28th, I believe there were over 500 shares of that post, and everybody believed it. You know, you can't believe what's on Facebook. you have to really know your facts. But first impulse, everybody believes what they read, and so from that point on, we had a lot of people doubting the care that we were giving their children at the daycare.
So how does that play out Monday? Are you getting phone calls? Are you getting visits from people, concerned parents?
On Monday, we had numerous calls from parents, former parents, staff, former staff, concerned about what they had read. We immediately contacted our licensing representative at DCFS, so she was aware of the situation. The Normal Police Department contacted us. And then a formal investigation began that morning.
Those hundreds of shares on Facebook reached a wider and wider social network in Bloomington Normal, far beyond the borders of Donius' actual network of friends. These days, Facebook settings by default are fairly private, meaning your friends are the only ones who will see most posts from most people. But Nate Carpenter, director of Convergent Media and the Social Media Analytics Command Center at ISU's School of Communication, says that's not necessarily an antidote to something going viral.
You know, as you post, especially if you create some interesting content, you know, people are going to share that. So your friends may share that. And when a friend shares something, your friend's friends start to see something. And it can grow like wildfire from there. So you do have to be, you know, cautious about what it is that you share. And again, there are people who are looking for attention. And if they really want attention, they can mark those posts public and make them, you know, able to be shared by anyone.
Police Chief Bleichner says Donius wasn't arrested for the Facebook post. She was arrested for allegedly lying to police and DCFS after they asked her if the allegations were true.
I'm not saying specifically specifically with this case, again, because I want to be cautious with that. But just anytime individuals post things, I think out of human nature, sometimes you may post information or exaggerate that, you know, certain things. But obviously, when you're contacted by officials or authorities inquiring about this and that it's potentially a criminal matter, at that point you need to be upfront. I mean, obviously, it is the easiest thing to say, but sometimes it's the most difficult thing to do. So certainly in that case, had this individual corrected the story, righted the ship there, if you will, we may not have gone down this road. It certainly would not have been a false police report or obstructing justice charges. So this is one of those situations, again, where that continuing with that story, knowing that it was false, was what the concern was.
Normal police went out of their way to exonerate Shining Star in their press release on the arrest last week. It says Shining Star fully and immediately cooperated with detectives. Here's Chief Bleichner.
It's not certainly our part of our mission, I guess, if you will, but certainly one of the things that our detectives were made aware of by employees at the Shining Star Learning Center was that they had received, harassing type phone calls or phone calls in which were, you know, how dare you do these kind of things, that you should be ashamed of ourselves, those kind of things. I mean, as well as we were made aware from the company there that they actually had lost individuals or business as a result of that, because people had pulled their children out of the academy there, out of the daycare. And so, again, our investigation throughout the whole thing, they were very cooperative. They were very forthright. They assisted us in that investigation, and through that point, you know, we had nothing to believe that any member of their organization played a part in that. And so because I felt that company had been either an intentional or an unintended victim out of that, and you know, additionally, I felt it was, you know, would be reasonable to include that information in the media release. So that was why I chose to do that. That's why I chose to make that statement, again, because just to share that, you know, we had no evidence that they've done anything wrong in this case, and again, in fact, they completed fully and cooperated fully with us throughout the course of the investigation.
Okay.
So that's why I felt it was important, again, because I think they did receive, their business could potentially have been harmed and did see some harm as a result of that false statement that was posted out there.
Despite the arrest, Waller is concerned about permanent damage to Shining Star.
We have lost clients over this situation. There are a few families who didn't give specifics why they pulled out, but from the time that post was made till current, we've had 7 children who have dropped out of the center, and that's a financial loss for the daycare. I would hope that we don't have an impact with future clients coming into the center. Hopefully everyone has read what Normal Police Department did put out with total exoneration of our center and staff, but it's been out there and a lot of people have read it, so I'm sure damage has been done. We're just going to try to move forward from this point.
Carpenter from ISU's School of Communication notes that big companies have sophisticated social media monitoring tools so they can keep an eye on reputation-threatening comments. That's why you'll likely get a courtesy response or even action if you tweet something bad about an airline or a cable company. They're listening.
I think the hard part is, you know, not very many businesses have the ability to, you know, really be paying attention 24/7. You know, we see really big companies, you know, like credit card companies and airlines, and you know, any you know, major restaurants with big customer service relationships. You know, they're monitoring. You know, they spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to monitor the social web just to, again, kind of, you know, deflect any problems that might come up. And if you're looking at a small community-based, you know, company, like many of which we have here in Bloomington Normal, it's very hard to keep tabs on everything that's going on at all times. So that response is difficult, and I think it really speaks to, you know, again, the need to develop, you know, communities in the social web and to have those really good relationships with customers in the social web.
Social media can be a force for good. Look no further than the recent hurricanes in Texas and Florida and how social media was the catalyst for empowering volunteers or collecting donations. But social media's darker side is what ensnared Waller and her business.
Honestly, I've never been a fan of Facebook. I tell our staff and even my own 2 children, you've got to be careful what you put out there because it's going to follow you wherever you go. people read it and take it at face value. And unfortunately, what's out there is not always the truth. And in our situation, we were advised not to respond. We did talk to all of our staff and ask that they keep it professional and not react like they would want to. I mean, it's human nature. You want to defend your family, your so-called friends from work.
It's an extraordinary amount of self-control.
Yes, and I was very impressed that everyone remained very professional throughout. It's very difficult when you read not only the posts that this parent had put on there, but then all the comments that people from the community make. We read a lot of comments from former staff who had worked for us that left in a not so positive manner. So then they were lashing back at the daycare, some of the comments they were making. Same thing with some families who had left our center for various reasons. They were reaching out to air their disgruntlement, but you know, we can't respond to that. And we, like I said, we kept it all very professional, but it's difficult to do, but it's a business situation. It's not your personal Facebook. So that's what I kept telling the staff. You know, we can't respond personally. It's a business.
The restraint that Waller and her staff showed by not posting their own response on Facebook after the original allegations is actually a good strategy. Carpenter talks about businesses that are most successful in defending their reputations on social media.
Well, businesses that are successful tend to have a community of supporters around them. In many cases, we talk about you know, in classes that we might teach or examples that we'll look at in the classroom or in client work, we'll talk about, you know, not feeding the trolls or, you know, allowing your community to back you up before you need to even step in and say anything. In most cases, if there's a, you know, legitimate complaint, businesses will try to handle it you know, off of the platform. They want to handle that in private because you don't want to make that any more public than it needs to be. I think, again, when businesses allow their community to step in, again, let's say there's a problem with customer service, you know, most community members who really support that business will step in and say, you know, my experience doesn't match what's going on, or it doesn't, you know, really replicate what we see in the real world. You know, can you elaborate? What was the problem? What was the issue? Again, we see those community members, you know, step in and defend their you know, preferences, or they defend the business that they support. So you know, most businesses will allow that to happen, and they'll allow, you know, we always talk about it, it's like nature taking its course. Again, that's why it's so important for so many of them to build these solid relationships in the social web. Not only do they get, you know, positive attention, they will get a community of people who will step in and support them when they need it.
Waller is eager to put the episode behind her, and she has some advice for other Bloomington Normal small businesses who may face similar threats to their reputation.
It's difficult to hold back and not say what you want to say, but you have to keep it professional. And in our case, we were just following the advice of what the police department and DCFS were suggesting we do. Other businesses may not have that same support that we did, and we greatly appreciate the support we received from both of those agencies. You just have to be careful what you put out there. I know I said that over and over, but you really do need to be careful what is said.
That's Jill Waller, executive director of a Shining Star Learning Center. Before that, it was Nate Carpenter from ISU's School of Communication and Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner. I'm Ryan Denham.
That was among the top stories heard and read by GLT users in 2017. It originally aired in September.
Support for GLT comes from ESA Eye Surgical Associates, with Doctors Brownstone, Crockett, Pinter, and Vise providing innovating treatment and vision-correcting surgeries for over 30 years. Routine vision care is also available. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to some of the top stories read and heard by GLT users in 2017. Another high reader mark came with GLT's investigative series Landlord v. Tenant. Here's part four of that series that aired in September. A mother with six children wanted to escape dangerous living conditions in Chicago when she moved to Bloomington. But she faced eviction from her home here for withholding rent from a landlord she says failed to make critical repairs and address an insect infestation. GLT's Judy Valente explored the difficulties tenants face in taking their landlords to court and talked with a landlord who says the public doesn't understand the pressures rental property owners face.
The first thing you notice about the rental home at 705 South Center Street is that the front door doesn't lock. The posts holding up the porch shake when you touch them. Inside the front hall, there's mold from floor to ceiling on one wall, and large pieces of the wall are missing due to apparent water damage. Moesha Tyner lives in this Bloomington rental with her six children. She takes me up a narrow staircase leading from the front door to her second floor unit.
Okay, so we'll walk upstairs now, some narrow, pretty steep steps here, which are not lit.
The stairs are wet.
The stairwell is dark. The hall light switch doesn't work. Inside the apartment, she shows me her bathroom. When we step on the floor, it sinks.
This is my bathroom where the most problem come in at, that as you can see around here, it's not safe or anything. As right here, you can see where it's caving in.
You're stepping on it and it's moving.
Yes, it's moving. I think it's very unsafe because I think one day, if the kids continue to take baths and showers up in here, it's going to cave in.
Then there are the bugs. Flies and mosquitoes come in.
Yes, very, very badly.
Several windows don't have screens. The glass is missing from windows in the basement, on the second floor in her children's playroom, and in the attic. Tyner pulls out a cell phone and displays photographs of her young daughter with insect bites.
This is one of my daughter's arm from her being bite from a bug. This is the side of her face being bite from a bug. These are the roaches when I sprayed.
Another photo shows the extent of the roach infestation, despite Tyner's attempts to spray the unit daily with insect repellent.
So you have about a few dozen dead roaches that you swept up after you sprayed.
Yes, they are. As you can see.
I see that you try to keep your kitchen as clean as possible.
Everything, all your food protected, because it's roaches. As you can see.
Tyner says the roaches were there when she moved in, but she had little choice but to take the 3-bedroom apartment when she arrived in Bloomington from Chicago about 2 years ago. It was big enough for her large family, and at $700 a month, it was something she could afford, barely, on her $9 an hour job at Burger King. Plus, she was happy to leave her previous neighborhood in Chicago.
I came from Chicago due to the fact we had a fire. A man was on our porch, dead. I came to Bloomington to change our life, and that's what I thought.
Tyner says she tried numerous times to contact her landlord, Cynthia Shepherd, asking her to make repairs and have the unit professionally fumigated.
Yes, I complained to my landlord several times. I was told not to contact her by phone, or she would be taking me to court to leave the premises.
Shepherd does business as Shackman Rentals and owns 50 buildings in Bloomington. Her units have been cited so many times for housing code violations, city officials say they've stopped counting. She is a regular in the administrative housing court, appearing on multiple cases in a single day.
Hello there. Are you Cynthia Shepherd? Okay, I'm Judy Valente. I just wanted to talk to you for a little bit about some of your properties.
I visited Shepherd in her office on Main Street. Tenants stream in and out to pay rent, usually in cash. Shepherd says she considers herself a champion of the poor.
My specialty is single mothers. And a lot of these women are very young, and a lot of them have multiple children, even though they're under 25. And the men are in prison. The men are not coming up with any money for them. And so they do run into problems, and they have to rely on their family and friends and co-workers to help them, and they're usually in the same boat.
Shepherd says the public generally doesn't understand the difficulties landlords face or the costs involved in keeping up properties. She says she spends about $10,000 a month to pay maintenance workers. After she retired as a paralegal with the Illinois Supreme Court, she says she had to take a job as a supermarket cashier to help support herself and pay her business expenses.
There's some tenants, usually the ones that I evict, you know, are going to be the ones that think I'm a slumlord, I guess. But I don't quite understand that because I have never had any money for myself. That's why I had to work a full-time and a part-time job. And that money, all my retirement money, goes into Shackman, into my rental properties, which is $10,000 a month.
Shepherd blames her tenants for the disrepair in their units. She says she has sent maintenance workers to address some of Tyner's complaints.
And what my maintenance guy noticed when he was up there to do some work, first of all, there were so many children running back and forth, he was actually afraid to leave tools there. And he thought if he turned around quickly, he would hurt somebody because they weren't always well behaved. So we pulled off.
Shepherd estimates she files 2 to 3 eviction notices against tenants each month. She says tenants fall behind in their rent payments because of what she views as the poor life choices they make.
A lack of work ethic. People don't feel like they have to work 40 hours a week. I usually work 90, and this was before I retired. But it seems like I still work 90 now. But I just think I put my work ethic first. I didn't have any children. And it seems like now people put children, have as many children as they possibly can, without being able to afford them. And I see that being a major problem, especially with single women.
But it's not that simple. For many people, like Moesha Tyner, survival is a daily struggle. When she lost her job at Burger King, she got another job as a cashier at Walmart. That job also paid $9 an hour with no benefits. She receives $800 a month in food stamps. Her estranged husband pays the gas and electric bill, but he too works a minimum wage job at a local bar restaurant. Tyner received an eviction notice from Shepherd after Tyner began withholding rent, hoping that it would force her landlord to make repairs and bring in professional fumigators.
All I can do if a tenant has stopped working with me, I have to proceed. If they work with me, you know, I think we can get through all of these things that need to be repaired.
Tyner's downstairs neighbor at the Center Street property has also begun withholding rent. Delilah Grant keeps a bucket in her living room to catch water leaking through her ceiling from Tyner's bathroom upstairs. Grant also complains about bugs.
We always pay rent on time, and then all of a sudden when we start seeing, you know, stuff that really need to be fixed or exterminated, you know, she would just push us to the side, but she would still call for her rent.
Grant saved some messages from Shepherd on her cell phone.
Delilah, this is Cindy Shepherd. I know you've been served with a 5-day notice. You haven't paid the amount that you owe, so I'm proceeding with the eviction. I thought you could be decent and give me a call or bring in some money to stop the eviction.
Grant has 3 children and works as a certified nursing assistant. She is now looking for someplace else to live.
I don't have $35 or $25 every time I go and try to put in an application for apartment, and then they want 2 or 3 months security and first months. How am I gonna come up with all that with on 3 kids? All you can do is just pray and do day by day. I mean, I still have a roof, but I don't know how long I'm gonna have a roof.
Lawyers who represent tenants say withholding rent is one of the worst strategies tenants can use. Under the Illinois Landlord-Tenant Code, tenants have to pay rent on time unless they can prove their unit is uninhabitable. Emily Petrie is an attorney with Prairie Legal Services, which helps low-income clients.
Under Illinois law, having issues with your landlord not making repairs and not fixing problems is not a complete defense to an eviction case. There's probably an argument to be made given all of the issues, and the judge would have to look at the specific issues, that rent should be a lot less. But it's really hard to argue that rent should be wiped out, that it should be $0, because the tenant was still staying there, was still able to have some use of their apartment.
Petrie says a better strategy is for the tenant to pay some rent or else place the whole month's rent in escrow with Prairie Legal Services or other legal counsel. That underscores another difficulty for low-income tenants. Most cannot afford representation. Prairie Legal Services says it doesn't have the funds or staff to take on landlord-tenant cases that don't have a strong legal defense.
When I went to court, it was a learning experience. I had to find a way to be my own advocate, but I knew that I had the heart to represent myself in a positive way.
One Bloomington tenant who went to court is Anthony Middleton, a part-time construction worker. He sued AB Rentals in Bloomington after a fire swept through its property at 812 West Washington Street last February. Middleton's unit, unlike the others, received only smoke damage. After the fire, AB changed the locks in all of the rental units. Middleton says he called the property manager a number of times seeking to get into his unit to collect his belongings. He was concerned about his computers and other electronic equipment. Before the landlord responded, his unit was burglarized.
The fire, it was heartbreaking. But the burglary after the fire, it took some time for me to function and get back to the normal things of life.
In court, AB Rentals was represented by counsel and also brought a witness to buttress its case. At times during the proceedings, Middleton appeared so frustrated he would place his head in his hands.
You know, I kind of like lost it a little bit, and I thought I was going to lose. But something in my heart kept saying, speak the truth, speak the truth. And everything to sort itself out. God was always with me.
Middleton sought $4,000 from AB as replacement value for the items that were stolen. In court, AB's representative, Lina Bunnell, maintained the company owed Middleton nothing and could not be held liable for the burglary. Judge David Butler ruled in Middleton's favor. He said AB was not responsible for replacement value of the stolen items, but still had to pay Middleton $1,700 to compensate for his loss.
I was telling the truth, so thank God that we have a justice system where the judge made the decision for me.
Lawyers who represent tenants say Middleton's success is an exception. Moesha Tyner, the resident at the Center Street apartment, represented herself in the eviction case brought by her landlord, Cynthia Shepherd. At a hearing in August, Tyner agreed to move out with her children within 30 days in exchange for not having to pay 3 months' back rent and other expenses her landlord claimed she was owed. The judge never heard Tyner's complaints about her living conditions because Tyner agreed to settle before the case went to trial.
If it beats for me having to pay $3,000 and not having a eviction on my background, I will take that.
Tyner is now seeking a new place to live. She has contacted some of the local homeless shelters, but she says they are either full or can't accept her with her 6 children.
It's hard, but I've been looking, and it's like I don't want to get another landlord that's going to have to go through this.
A few weeks ago, Shepherd did send some workmen over to Tyner's unit to patch up some of the walls and ceiling and paint the outside of the house. Shepherd says she's getting Tyner's old unit ready for new renters. I'm Judy Valente.
Most landlord-tenant disputes in the county are settled out of court, but those who do come to court usually come before McLean County Associate Judge David Butler. Butler's the judge who signed the eviction notice for Moesha Tyner to vacate her unit on Center Street after Tyner reached an agreement with her landlord to move out. Butler tells GLT's Judy Valente that in landlord-tenant cases, it's often difficult to balance human concerns with the mandate of the law. Since GLT aired the original report, people in the community have come forward offering jobs, housing, help, and other assistance for Tyner and her children. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to some of the top stories of the year, as heard on GLT and read online at WGLT.org. We first brought you the story of 26-year-old Jordan Becker of Bloomington in 2015 as part of a series on transgender individuals living in the Twin Cities. Becker said he always wanted to be a soldier and is currently a decorated military policeman in the Army Reserves. Now, Donald Trump says he wants to rid the military of thousands of transgender soldiers like Becker. GLT's Judy Valente went back and talked to Becker in July when President Trump made that announcement.
Bloomington resident Jordan Becker joined the Army National Guard in 2008 as Jordan Elizabeth Becker, a woman. In 2014, he dropped Elizabeth from his name, began hormone therapy, and had surgery to become a man. At the time, transgender individuals were not allowed to serve in the military, and he left the service. When the Obama administration changed that rule, Becker says he was ecstatic. He promptly reenlisted, this time in the Army Reserves. President Trump announced on Twitter last week that he wants transgender men and women out of the military. Becker says he is determined to stay.
I'm overwhelmed by the support that I've received after Trump tweeting that, but also it's extremely disheartening because I know for myself, I've worked so hard to get my gender changed so I can conform to the male standards in the military. And I know that me and the thousands of other transgender troops, we have all worked so hard to get where we are today.
Has your status caused any issue with your fellow soldiers?
My unit that I'm in now, they're phenomenal. I'm actually not sure who knows that I'm transgender. The full-time staff knows, my lieutenant, my first sergeant, human resources. So it's kind of on a need-to-know basis, but they've been phenomenal. They have done nothing but work with me and work for me.
Do you think your transgender status has any effect on your ability to do your job as a soldier?
No, in fact, I think that it increases my ability. Just with all the adversity that I deal with personally for being transgender, I think that it makes me a very great candidate to be in the military. Being transgender has made me very mentally and emotionally tough.
What about your actual physical duties? Does it affect that at all?
No, and that's, I mean, I have to laugh at that because there's not a single thing that I can't do. I mean, in fact, I can do things better. I can do more push-ups. I have more endurance. I have had several surgeries to have my body fit what I feel the gender that I am. I've had a mastectomy, phalloplasty surgery. So aside from, you know, the normal recovery times for any surgery that anybody has, I can do my duty, if not better, than I could 4 years ago before I started transitioning. I obviously want people to see me as a male. So in the military, I want to conform to the male standards, especially the fitness standards. And that requires a shorter run time as a male. And more push-ups. So, in fact, I think being transgender has made me more physically fit now more than ever.
What about the handling of weapons?
I can shoot a weapon better than I did before, and I'm not saying that's because of hormones. I think a lot of it is also emotional and mental. I feel more at peace with myself because I am who I always thought I should be. When I hear people say that transgender troops are physically and emotionally unfit, that just blows my mind. Like, I don't understand where people get these things. Where do they get that notion that we are any less fit than the next soldier?
How could you convince them that that's not so?
Well, first of all, just on the civilian side of things, if we take out the military aspect, to start hormones, to have surgery, that requires going through therapy, talking to a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and it requires quite a bit of documentation just to even get my gender changed from female to male on my driver's license, let's say. You know, so we already go through a strenuous vetting process, if you will. So if a psychiatrist and a doctor and a therapist see me physically fit, I don't know how the military can see me unfit.
The issue of paying for hormone therapy and gender-altering surgery has come up in this debate. Is that not a legitimate issue?
I think it's an excuse. I cannot speak to what other surgeries the military pays for. I know that the military pays for breast reduction surgeries if it's deemed medically necessary. But for me personally, my hormones are $15 a month. That's it. And if you look at the small percentage of troops that are actually transgender, it's estimated that there's 6,000 active duty military members that are transgender and 15,000 overall if you include the National Guard and Reserve components. That is such a small percentage. And in addition to that, everyone's transition is different. Some people only stay on hormones and they opt to have no surgeries. Some people have all the surgeries to make themselves feel better and conform to the body that they feel like they should be in. So everyone's journey is different. Not every single soldier is going to have all these surgeries. And so if you think about the roughly 15,000 transgender troops total, not 15,000 of these troops are going to have all the surgeries or even a surgery.
You paid for most of your surgeries, if I recall correctly.
I did. I paid for my top surgery out of pocket, my mastectomy out of pocket. In addition to that, I pulled out a separate policy, which I'm paying for on my own through Blue Cross Blue Shield, that covered my other surgeries that I've had.
Why do you think this issue is coming up again?
Part of me thinks that Donald Trump hasn't done a lot of things that he's promised the people. And to me, this is him trying to say, hey, I am doing something. I'm doing something that I promised you. So I think he's just getting bored. You know, Donald Trump never served. He avoided the draft. I would personally love for him to come stand right in front of me and tell me that I am a burden to the military and that I am physically and emotionally unfit. I would love if he could say that to my face.
Do you feel better acceptance generally in society of transgender people?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, you know, people that do know me accept me. For instance, there's a soldier in my unit that for one of her high school projects, she did a project on transgender people. And she told me, she said, if I would have known that you were transgender before I got to know you, she said, I probably would have judged you. She didn't find out until later into our friendship that I was transgender. And she said, I'm glad I got to know you because now I see that you are not different. You're just Jordan. And if I would have known beforehand, I probably wouldn't have wanted to be your friend. And so there's just that big misconception.
Are there any moments of tension or embarrassment that you run into because of your transgender status?
There's that potential. And back in 2014, I had just started hormones and I had already had my mastectomy and I had to be in the same barracks as all the females. So I walk into the female bathroom, I'm embarrassed, other female soldiers see me, they're wondering why this guy is in the bathroom, so they were embarrassed. It's just, I mean, us as a transgender community go through that embarrassment because not everyone, you know, everyone can be at different stages in their transition.
How about now that you've pretty much completely transitioned, has there also been other moments like that?
There's been moments mentally where I'm just scared that someone is going to look at me and say, that guy is trans. And I know that it's probably completely irrational, but there is that fear, and there's that fear of rejection and that fear of, I mean, even getting potentially beat up. Being transgender is a thing that a lot of people don't understand, people like Donald Trump, and I think that that's why they spout off all this ignorance. So I think that as we become a more informed community, and in a lot of ways, I think that we as a country are kind of more divided now than ever, but I think that we are becoming a more liberal society. And as people open up their minds to understand things that they don't know, we can get along a lot better.
This policy has not gone into effect yet. The Pentagon says it doesn't know when it will go into effect. So what message would you have for your superiors in the military right now?
Right now, more than ever, I think that we are a very divided country right now because of Donald Trump. I really have no words. I think I'm still kind of in shock, mostly because Donald Trump tweeted it. That's not very professional. So that just blows my mind in itself. There's a lot of transgender service members that are very prominent in the transgender community. They're on Facebook. I would love for all of us to get together and stand right in front of Donald Trump and our superiors and ask them what it is about us that they deem unfit.
Why do you still want to serve in the military, given that there isn't general consensus about transgender people or even gay people at this point in the military?
I ask myself that a lot, and I've been asking myself that since I joined. And that's the other interesting thing about our transgender community serving in the military. I have not heard of a single person saying, okay, I'm trans. Donald Trump wants to kick me out. I'm done. All I've heard is, I'm transgender and I'm going to fight. I would love for Donald Trump to find another group of people that will say, you don't want me in your military, but here I am and I'm going to fight to stay in. I love what I do. And the military is kind of a weird thing. Sometimes you just can't explain. You know, it's a love-hate relationship. But for as long as I can stay in, I will, because I want to serve my country. I always have. And I will continue to do so. And I will not go down without a fight.
Jordan Becker is a member of the Army Reserve. Thanks so much for talking about this.
Thank you. I'm so glad that I'm getting the opportunity to let my voice be heard, and hopefully I am a reflection of the thousands of other voices that cannot be heard.
Thanks a lot. I'm Judy Valente.
Last May, Jordan Becker received an Achievement Award from the Army Reserves for outstanding service to the military. After President Trump's tweet promising to ban transgender troops, Pentagon officials said they have no immediate plans to do so. A 2016 RAND Corporation survey estimated there are anywhere between 2,000 and 11,000 transgender active duty troops out of approximately 1.3 million members of the armed forces. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Tomorrow on Sound Ideas, hear more of the top GLT stories of 2017 and the latest episode of the podcast Suspect Convictions. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Judy Valente and Ryan Denham. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.